I'm going to reminisce about my childhood again, just a little bit. And the reason I am is because for me it has a great contrast, I think, to the way or the circumstances in which we live today. And there are insights that I have as a result of this. And my sister and I went to Orange, New Hampshire, and Canaan, New Hampshire on Monday. And those of you who know me, I do this at least, I would say, 6 times a year. And Orange, New Hampshire is a town right at the base of Mount Cardigan, which is a 3,100-foot mountain. And my grandparents had homes, had the last home on the road that led to the mountain. Their property bordered the state park. It was their summer home. And so here in 1947, my parents retreated to this little place, and there we were, the base of a mountain, and our top of the mountain, which I thought was a lollipop when I first saw it. And even kids I didn't see. So anyway, my point really is that there was a community of people in this little town. Couldn't have been more than 150 people at that time, 160 people. This now, even with some building, it's I went and looked it up, it's about 285 people in Orange, New Hampshire. And just to give you where it is, it's about 25 miles from Hamilton, Dartmouth College. And so anyway, there were remarkable people in this little community. I remember a woman named Fairy Hoxley, and it's a one-room schoolhouse from 1 through 6, and Fairy Hoxley was the teacher at the one-room schoolhouse. I was not old enough to go to school, but from time to time, siblings were allowed to go to different events. And she was clearly a remarkable woman, and had a very wonderful presence about her, and kindness, and she had this great ability to get the older children to teach the younger children, and keep the whole thing together, and it was a really nice community there. And she was a friend of the family. And then there was Ralph and Ruby Peasley, who had one son who was somewhat sick, and reposed in his 40s. And Ralph was a painter, and a carpenter, and he did work in all the little houses here and there down in Canaan, and wherever he did work. And his wife was also a school teacher, and she went into the town of Enfield. And they were people of great hospitality and great love. And I remember Ralph Peasley coming up the little road. His house was kind of got on the little road to our place. And he was in the fall, and he was holding in his hand a jackrabbit, which he had just shot, and which was natural in that environment. People shot deer, and they shot jackrabbits, and partridge hunting, and so on, and they were all to feed the family. And I remember it so vividly, because it was obviously striking to see this little rabbit. Anyway, my mom cooked her up, and cooked them up, and so we had rabbit soup for dinner. But really what it said was, Ralph and Ruby were really wonderful people and loving people. And then there was Harry Powell, and he's my favorite of all the characters that were there. Harry basically was a logger. He had a little tiny caterpillar, and he needed logs taken down. Harry would get together with his friend Paul Caro, and they would come to your farm and take down the logs, and once again, an amazing, simple, but clearly loving person. So this was, there are many more people I didn't mention, but this was the atmosphere. And it turns out that these people, we left the home, when we stayed there 2 minutes and bought a farm and came in. But the people that we met there were always friends. They were friends for until we went then into Lebanon. They were still friends. We'd go out and drop by and see these folks. And they were Paul Paro, who is the fellow down the road from Harry, Paro, not Powell, down the road from Harry Powell, and they logged together. And he had a very nice farm, and it was on Orange Brook, which is a nice size brook.
There's an uneasiness, tremendous uneasiness, I think. And I mean,
And you think, why? Why do they depend on angels? And I think that the reality is that if we're honest about the media, we can, I think, see that the media has led us down a very, very dark path. And so much of what is projected through the television and the various programs and so on has to do with carnality, sex, drugs, familiarity that is not moral among people, and I think when you look at this, why are some people so uneasy? And I think it's part of it is that they're feeding upon things that actually their conscience knows should be filtered out somehow. The conscience knows, it still knows. And I suppose at the point in which a person dies completely spiritually, their conscience doesn't function any longer, but the conscience knows that what they have bought into and what is now flooding into their lives is a little, it's off, it's off the tread of godliness. And of course, we know with the media that it is godless, and it projects that image, and it exalts, aggression and power and so on. And so there's this change in the culture, but I think it's pretty much everywhere. And it actually affects all classes. I thought about this. No. All classes are affected. Now, there are many individuals who are free of this, and they labor and start with their great strength to resist. But how do you resist something which is so prevalent and so powerful and so insidious that enters your home continuously? So the music and the imagery and so on, and it's very, very difficult to do. And I think what made these people that I mentioned before remarkable is that they were all people who labored. Even the ones lifting the teachers, they labored because the context in which they lived, they gardened, not just a little tiny garden, for beautiful flowers, but a big garden, sufficient through canning and so on, preparation to get the family through winter in terms of vegetables and canning pork and chicken and so on. And so there was this labor and that there was built into their lives. And particularly Harry Powell and Paul Arrow, these people worked. And they got there early and they left late. And they worked all the time. And it was, honestly, it was a joyfulness to them. When I was 6 years old, we had, I don't know what it was, I tried to look up the hurricane. All I know is the wind came through our farm, came in and knocked over all the big trees. And so, maybe it was a microburst of wind, but once they're knocked over, and the thing to do is you call a fellow who cuts the lumber and you take the trees out. So Harry Powell and Paul Arrow came with their little caterpillar, and I was not yet in the first grade, and I was hanging around watching them. I was a big kid, and things were different. Kids that grew up a lot faster. And so here I am watching them and trying to follow them around, and I don't know at what point, but certainly within a few weeks of it, they probably were out of this. And it demonstrated love, but also demonstrated as a symbol of their labor. That's what it was. And I think that people want to avoid labor today. They don't want to work hard. It's crazy. You see, Moses and I walk around here, and you go by different places where there are construction crews working. And I'm telling you, what's wrong here? And I think because they're exhausted. I think they come to work exhausted. Because I think the life that people are living is an exhausting life. A life of the passions without God is exhausting. Where do you get your strength to push back against the energies, the dark energies that come through the various intrusions? But basically, the comparison is, of course, my friend Eric Powell, Paul Powell. And the thing is that this little axe is such a beautiful symbol. And it's a symbol of labor. And I do think that sort of hard labor at work that God has given us, that those who enter into the labor that God has given us are accepting an obedience. And if they perform it with love, what happens is the dark energies of the passions. Now, the problem with all the imagery is that it releases dark energies in the soul. And those dark energies come up, and they exhaust you, and they confuse your mind, they darken you, and they literally actually darken you in such a way that it takes years off your life. This is just the way it is. So here you have these fellows really laboring and working hard and doing what God has given them to do. This is their vocation, as it were. This is what their calling was. I don't think they thought it was right that way, but they certainly embrace it. And it's something that God gave them. It's something that God gives all men and all women, is this opportunity to labor and perform the obediences that God gives us in the flesh, and perform them in love. And when this happens, the dark energies of the unrestrained passions are filled with light, and they are transformed into joyful expressions of compassion and care. That is, we, and this is why, for example, like monastic life, which is a very good example, monastic life is very rigorous. And monastic, for the most part, there are scholars and so on, and then the clergy, whatever. But everyone has to engage in labor. The monastery judges it on a mountain, not us. Everyone. And they were constantly laboring. If you were talking to a person, they would be making a prayer robe, or they would be knitting something, or they would always be laboring. And the reason is because the labors sanctify, as it were, and transform the passions and create a peace within the heart and mind and soul. And as we know, monastics do prostrations. Prostrations, you come down on your knees and bow your head, touch the floor, and they'll do 500 prostrations. And why? Because the labors that they engage in fight the passions. They don't just fight the passions, they transform that energy into a positive energy of love and grace. And so here we are in our circumstances, and I think, you know, I happen personally, I happen to be careful, right? Because I don't want to impose upon you my own reflections as though you share them. But I think, from what I can tell, there's a real sense of depression in our society. I think people are depressed. And you can attribute it to, coronavirus, which we hope is going to be dissipated, and now there are flare-ups of it. But you look at what's going on in the country, and you think to yourself, like, gosh, what is going on? It's called disorder. It's insane. And I don't think that's a political statement. I think it's an observation. And it seems in every area, this is just this disorder, and incomprehensible chaos, as it were. And you realize there's something wrong, and that which is wrong, in my opinion, His grace and His love. And people become totally self-reliant, and they sink deeper and deeper into what? Their passions. And the passions bring depression. There's no question about it. Passions bring depression. And that depression is greed. And I revise my opinion. I would walk by these people who are working on the railroad tracks here and there. Now, you know, be great. It's unbelievable. What are they doing? They're standing around here, and nothing's happening. A little bit happens. My first thing was to attribute it to the unions, because I actually worked on a union job years and years and years ago, and I was told to slow down because you're going to kill the job. And so you're supposed to keep your face up. And that was my first. It's just the union. And then I thought to myself, most recently, no, these people are so profoundly depressed. When they get to work, they have hardly moved. They're depressed because they're living a life feeding on the powers of darkness. And they're just depressed. And one of the things that triggered this, I have a series of them. And one of the fellows really described me a lot. Why is this so struggling? Sorry, what is this? And I said, really? Because the life he led and the life he was trying to lead in labor just didn't work together well. So I do believe that there is a depression. And that depression has to do with a kind of decadence, a submission to the powers and energies that are in our society. And without realizing that, we need to push back. And how do we push back? Well, we push back by our prayers, we push back by our attendance of the divine services, our petition, participation in the life of Christ is the first really obligation. And of course, the second is to love our neighbors, and to love our families, and to do good things. And I'm just going to leave it with this. William Blake from the 18th century said something, which is a summary, actually. You got it out of the song. He said, "We become what we behold." And it's a very fascinating. There are people who behold beauty, and it changes them. It actually changes the way you look at and feel about life. It lifts you up. And we know this, and thank God we're in the church. Because it's not just a place to worship, it's actually beautiful. There is a divine, divine term, form, as it were. There's an emanation on high that comes down, and there are people who are gifted to take that energy for beauty and manifest it. And the reward, of course, is that people who do this kind of work typically have a sense of a very wonderful sense of warmth in themselves. Whether a person's a gardener or a carpenter, it doesn't matter what. To do work with a sense of grace and beauty. And so there are these things that so we become what we behold, and so if in our hearts and minds we're looking at the world in terms of its beauty, it changes us and can give us the strength to fight back the tendency to drift back into the passions and really dissipate ourselves. But there's something there are other things called truth, and then of course love. And so in Psalm 119 and verse 36 begins, "Incline my heart unto thy testimonies, and not to covetousness. Turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity, and quicken thou me in thy way. Establish thy word unto thy servant, who is devoted to thy
Turn away my reproach and thy fear, for thy judgments are good. Behold, I have longed after thy precepts. Quicken me in thy righteousness. And I think this, in a sense, fleshes out, we become what we behold. And we being, there's such a really image of likeness of God, and we have creative powers. We have creative powers. And God has given us, in a sense, the grace and the power and the authority to create on behalf of goodness and behind of truth. And may we all dedicate our lives to it. And we have to stop it, breaking away.